On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk John Cusack movies with Better Off Dead and Pushing 10. I'm really sorry your mom blew up, Ricky.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills, there will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome once again to another hot episode of Video Culture. I am your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week is one of my favorite actors of all time, is John Cusack.
Yeah, I'd have to consider him almost like one of the pillars of what Video Culture stands for.
John Cusack, I think he's been in lots of movies that I think would be considered cult classics, and more than just one movie that would be considered cult classics.
Yeah.
One of the movies that we'll talk about in the moment, Better Off Dead, but he's also been in Gross Point Blank. He's also been in
High Fidelity.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of get brain locked in the moment, but
being John Malkovich.
Being John Malkovich, Con Air. War Inc. Lots of really good movies. And that's at least the ones off the top of my head in the moment without having a whole list compiled to rattle them
say
off.
Say Anything. Yeah.
Yeah, how can you forget Say Anything? Iconic, holding the boombox up with the Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
I mean, that's iconic. I mean, we both throw the word iconic around a lot. That is iconic.
Yeah, it is a very iconic scene.
I mean, how many times has it been copied in films and television?
Right. Yeah.
Thousands
of times. Yep. And it's been parodied, dozens of times. Yep. And John has even been in, John Hughes, movie.
Yes. I mean, I really think if you were going to have a Mount Rushmore of video culture people,
right,
John Cusack would have to be on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the reasons he'd have to be on it is because of the first movie we're going to be talking about today.
Right. Which is Better Off Dead. So, Better Off Dead was done in 1985, mm-hmm. And he was already in like 16 Candles, like kind of playing a dorky character. He was a friend of like Anthony Michael Hall's character.
Yeah. And he was in the famed Brat Pack.
Yeah. And a little bit. I mean, that's kind of where he got his start.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, Hollywood, after Fast Times at Ridgemont High, was just on this really, like, sort of binge of, like, teenage movies. Like, what else do we have? Like, then we have John Hughes, and then here comes this guy with this really witty comedy, which is Better Off Dead. Yep. And then here he gets to play kind of like John Cusack kind of gets to take the lead.
Yeah, but that man you're talking about is a man by the name of Savage Steve Holland.
Yeah,
Savage which may
Steve
be
Holland.
My favorite, one of my favorite creative names ever. Because you never see him listed as Steve Holland.
No.
It's always Savage Steve Holland.
Yeah, that's the way his listing is. And I don't know whether to call him Savage Steve or Steve.
I just always say the whole thing. But Savage Steve Holland was an animator who got into live action film. But his background is in animation. And that's sprinkled throughout his work, especially in Better Off Dead.
Right. But Better Off Dead being this very farcical, like, kind of story. The story isn't farcical.
No.
But, like, what happens and the gags that are in it are really kind of, like, somewhat over the top.
Yes.
But they're really kind of done so tastefully and so great that they're not total parodies of themselves.
Let's quickly knock out what the plot is, because you're right. The plot is very basic.
Yeah.
The plot's about John Cusack's character is named Lane Meyer, and Lane Meyer is in love with this really popular girl in school, and they've been dating for about 6 months. Beth.
Right.
Beth is the very very typical 80s hot girl. She's blonde. She's very much a valley girl.
Right.
She's statuesque.
Right. And Beth is played by, and I've got to get my notes up here because I don't have the notes in order, but.
But she was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Banda Weiss.
Banda Weiss, yes.
Yeah, Banda Weiss. And she was also, she's been in some other movies since then, Nightmare on Elm Street. She's been in some Jason Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah. She had a little run as a horror actress, which I always thought was pretty interesting.
Right.
So they're dating, and at the beginning of the film, she decides to break up with Lane to go to date the head of the high school ski team, because the movie takes place in Northern California,
right,
where skiing is a thing that happens.
Yeah,
and then you actually foreign to you and me here in this the flyover state of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, like a high school ski team. Like, yeah, this doesn't
sound like, even at the time, I'm like, is that a thing that they have?
Right, it doesn't seem correct.
But anyway, so she breaks up with him, and Lane is very obsessed with her. Like he's just so enamored with her, and we'll get into the farcical way they represent this in a moment. But he spends the entire movie trying to think of ways to win her back. And he's got his best friend, Charles DeMar, played by Curtis Armstrong from Revenge of the Nerds, famously played Booger in Revenge of the Nerds.
And Curtis Armstrong, let's just pause for a second, too. I mean, Curtis is also one of these great sort of like guys who we love and part of what we would consider like the video culture, kind of guys that would be at like any of the Comic Cons or like whatever. I mean, he's also very iconic.
Yeah, like if I ran into Curtis Armstrong, I'd be excited because he's part of my childhood.
Yeah,
and he's a really underrated guy. Super talented, great comedic timing. He's a funny dude.
Yeah, I mean, he was in Risky Business. He was in Better Off Dead.
The Revenge of the Nerds movies. And another Savage Steve Holland movie, which we'll talk about later on, called One Crazy Summer.
One Crazy Summer.
Which is a great movie, but we'll get into that later.
Right.
So they spend the movie trying to basically help Lane get his girlfriend back. And, of course, things don't quite go as planned. But that's basically the crux of the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and Lane in the movie meets another girl, and they have conflicts. There's a big showdown with the sports captain ski guy.
Right. And then you get... You know, you kind of get to the end of the movie where he's like, he does the thing and like, you know, kind of makes it onto the ski team or like wins the bet and like beats the guy down the hill to become the captain of the ski team. And then here comes Beth, like the girl that he's been after trying to win back. Yeah. Like, you know, she's like, oh, yeah, you know, basically like, I want to be with you now. And he's like, nope. I want to be with a new girl.
The girl who actually likes me for who I am.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's all, and it, you know what? It's all very basic.
Yeah, it is.
It's tropey. It's very obvious. But that's not what makes Better Off Dead great. What makes it great is the stuff you were talking about. It's all these absurd little details.
Yeah.
That are crammed into the film.
Right. I mean, but let's just go over, like, before we get to the gags, like, his dad is, like, trying to... you know, identify with him and trying to use the slang like by reading books. And he's trying to set him up with another girl to try to get over his depression because he's depressed about losing this other girl. He's got the weird, neighbor, across the street. He's got a paper boy who's after him for $2. Yeah.
He's got a rival he drag races with in the street. Yeah. All these typical like 80s teen movie tropes.
Yeah.
And they're all just in this film, and they're all kind of layered on top of each other, and it would all be very boring and standard, except what the devil is in the details, and that's what makes this movie great, is the way it's all presented.
Well, we can use, for one example, like, the thing about it is the gags that it shows, like, for instance, I'll use it as an example, the scene where he goes to math class, okay, and he goes to math class, and the guy, you know, that's speaking, the teacher who's speaking or giving the lecture, he's talking like it's like stereo instructions or something. I mean, it seems like this is like doctorate level, sort of speech.
Super dry, and it's meant to be over the top dry. What's fun about it is everyone else in the class, except for Lane, except for John Cusack's character, yeah. is eating up like it's a comedy routine. Like, they're, yeah. like, laughing and clapping,
oh, they're
cheering.
Like, yeah, they're so enamored. They're, like, glued to his every word, which is just, like, complete opposite of every other teen movie you've ever seen, yeah. where the teacher gets up there talking about stuff, and the whole class is, like, chewing gum or twirling yeah. their hair. You know, the whole class, but it's to represent this idea that, you know, like, this is the way that John Cusack, like his character, this is the way Lane Meyer feels, yeah. is like everybody else is with it and I'm like really behind yeah. Yeah. and everybody's done this homework and they've got like these printed out sheets and charts and files and he's got like
a scarf paper with gum stuck in it. Yeah.
I mean, it's just like,
people have like flow charts and like these fancy manila folder things and like just boxes of like notes and he's got like this crumpled up sheet of paper with gum on
it. Yeah, with gum stuck to it. I mean, it's just like,
yeah.
But yeah, that's the thing is that's one thing I love is because it's not just doing those jokes to be funny. It's doing those jokes because that's how it makes you feel yeah. being in that moment. You yeah. know what I mean?
It does a good job of giving you the feeling of being that age.
Right.
It's all absurd, but because when you're that age, everything kind of feels absurd around you. Mm-hmm. You feel out of sorts. Everything feels kind of alien and weird when you're a teenager mm-hmm. and you're hormonal. And the most important thing in the world to you is that hot girl who maybe broke your heart or that you want to date.
Or the way to get her back is yeah. to ski down this like really dangerous hill that yeah. you can.
I'm going to do to really impress her.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, like I'm going to yeah. do this. I'm going to jump off this thing and she'll take me back. You know. Yeah. Whatever,
oh
yeah.
man, I've got to go to my terrible burger job and it's you know it's oh it's so gross working in this fast food restaurant.
Right.
And so much of that. It's all just filtered through this, like, again, this idea of that Savage Steve Holland. Again, I say the whole thing.
Right.
He has a way of looking at it. It's a very cartoony way of seeing the world.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's kind of got this kind of madcap animation quality to it.
Right. Well, there's a couple of, you know, what I call, like, animation breakaways.
Yes.
In the film that really sort of also set the film apart from other films of that yeah. time. So there's one time where he's, like, at lunch doodling. And then, like, the paper, like, the characters kind of come to life and talk to him. So he draws out Beth, and he draws out, you know, the other guy, the captain of the ski team. And then this monster comes to eat, you know, the captain. And the monster kind of, like, laughs about it.
And the monster stops and goes, Lane, you got to get over this. You're obsessed with this. You got to quit it.
Yeah.
And he's yelling at the paper. He's like, no, you're obsessed. And he wads the paper up, you know.
Right.
And then when he's in this burger restaurant job, he daydreams about... You know, basically animating a burger and bringing it to life like he's Dr. Frankenstein.
Right.
And it's just, it's absurd and it's silly, but it's so much fun.
It is. I mean, and that scene where it's like this playing the Van Halen, you know, everybody wants.
Oh, yeah. Like when he animates the hamburger, it becomes yeah. a claymation
yeah.
breakaway. And it's right. almost like something out of UHF almost.
Yeah, it does. I mean that probably
the best stylistic comparison to Better Off Dead
right.
to me is UHF. If you've seen UHF and not Better Off Dead, that'll give you an idea of what Better Off Dead's like. But right. anyway, so he has this claymation sequence of this animated hamburger, and it basically is singing and dancing to Van Halen.
Right.
And it should be the dumbest thing in the world, but it makes you smile, and it's so much fun.
It is a lot of fun. And, yeah. and I didn't put it in my notes, but I'll go ahead and say now that, like, originally, the movie producers wanted to take that part out. And he was like, no, let's leave it in and let the test audiences, like, see how they react to it. And they loved it. And they said that was, like, what, like almost every person they interviewed afterward said that they loved that scene. So they're like, okay, well, we can't take it out now, you know.
Well,
and it is. It's fantastic. Well, it's a nice little breakaway kind of thing. And that everything about this movie, all the gags, all the funny stuff, you know, the... All the funny jokes, all of the running gags, like the $2 the newspaper.
Let's talk about the $2 thing for a second.
Okay.
There's a subplot where the paperboy basically is owed money from Lane's family. And it's just $2. But Lane doesn't have any money, so he keeps blowing the paperboy off. So throughout the movie, the paperboy will suddenly just show up like a horror movie slasher like Jason and say, where's my $2? And start chasing him.
Yeah.
And it's always shot like a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny. There's one scene where it's even like Night of the Living Dead, where he's got like an army of paperboys chasing him, trying to get this $2 back.
Yeah. But that's the thing, is like there's these running gags throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Like everybody, all these strangers coming up to Lane and asking, now that he's not dating Beth, could they ask you know, what they have run with if they asked her
at
out.
At one point, it's even the great guy we talked about before, Taylor Negron, who plays the postman. It's like, here's your mail. Oh, by the way, I heard you're not dating Beth anymore. Would you feel weird if I asked her out?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, there's that running gag. There's a running gag with his brother being weird and, like, cutting weird stuff out of cereal boxes.
It's sending away for, like, catalogs and stuff. And you think it's, like, getting, like, x-ray specs and stuff. But everything he gets actually works.
Right.
You see him ordering like, a ray gun. You think, oh, it's like a kid's ray gun. No, he actually builds a ray gun that works.
Yeah.
It doesn't go anywhere. It's just a throwaway gag.
Right.
But stuff like that. Like, at what point, he orders a book on how to pick up women. And then 15 minutes later into the movie, if you've forgotten about that, they have Lane coming home, and here's like a ruckus in his brother's room. He opens up the door, and his little brother, who's like 10, has like a cocktail party with like 20 women in his room. Mm-hmm. Lane just kind of stares at it blankly, shuts the door back like I'm going to ignore this. And it's just this one little throwaway gag, and it's so funny the way it's shot. It's framed like that. It's just that famous shot in The Graduate.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny.
Right.
Because it doesn't overplay any of the jokes. It's just really rapid fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters themselves don't act silly.
Mm-mm.
They act very much like real people who are just having these kind of, who live in an absurd world.
Well, I mean, even the kid, like you said, that plays the paper boy who's after him for $2. I mean, he's really after him for $2. I mean, this is, you know, like his life really depends on it. Yeah. And even, you know, at one point, like, rounds up all the other newspaper boys to kind of like, you know, chase him down or whatever, to shake him down for the, you know, for his paper delivery. I mean, there's also running gags like his mom, like, making all this weird food.
His mom,
like,
doesn't know how to cook, basically.
No, like boiled bacon and, you know, like
it's
weird
bright
octopus
green for
stuff.
Something, yeah.
I mean, it's
got raisins in it. You like raisins. Yeah. My favorite absurd joke is the guys he drag races with are two Japanese brothers.
Right.
One of them is played by the guy who played the main villain in Karate Kid Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And that character has the weirdest little tic. He talks like he's Howard Cosell.
Right.
And they explain it as that's how he learned English, was by watching Wild World of Sports. And in the entire movie, they basically dub him with a Howard Cosell impersonator.
Right.
Like, at first, you think he's just doing the bit to kind of narrate their drag racing, but then you see him in, like, everyday life still talking like Howard Cosell. And it's such a funny image to see, you know, the bad guy from Karate Kid Part 2 talk like a, you know, an old American sportscaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they have the speakers on top of their car or whatever, and they, you know, they drag race. So one brother, you know, doesn't, I guess, you know, speak English, and the other one learned how to speak while watching Wild World of Sports. And yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, they know who he is, like Lang Maya, you know,
a man just, beaten down by life.
It's just, it's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah,
and I love how the fact that, like, whatever happens in his life, like, automatically, like, everybody knows, like, as soon as he, you know has the run-in with the captain and says, okay, you know, I can beat you down, you know, the K-12, just you and me, I'll beat you. He's like, okay, Sunday noon. And then he walks off, and then, like, on the announcement on the
thing, like right after
it's just like
Myers will be facing whatever his name is on the K-2 this Sunday.
Right.
Yeah,
it's absolutely it's absolutely great. So some of it, I mean, because it's not total like Airplane, and it's not total like Saturday Night Live gags, but it's not total like normal, you know, sort of funny like Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
This is, you know, or any other Brat Pack film. John, you know, like John Hughes film. It's something different.
Yeah, Savage Steve Holland, what he does is he kind of packs the background in the world around the characters with all these cartoony things. But the characters themselves are pretty much, you know, people.
Mm.
Sometimes they may have an absurd moment. For the most part, they're not farcical. They're not like, you know, Leslie Nielsen in Naked Gun.
Right.
You know, it's not like they're not really in on the joke.
Right.
They just kind of exist and just accept this weird stuff as their reality.
Right.
Like, yeah, my mom made bacon that's green because she boiled it.
Right.
Yeah, my brother's building a spaceship, you know.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
But not all the characters are very, like, sort of 2D either. You know, like, they have, you know, depth and backstories to them, you know, whatever. Like,
It's like they're plucked out of a real teen movie and set into this absurd world.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And that's really what makes it work.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite gags, which we haven't even really talked about yet, the reason it's called Better Off Dead is as Lane's been dumped by Beth, he keeps trying to kill himself, or he keeps thinking about killing himself. And every time he tries to start to do it, something goes wrong to prevent him from killing himself.
Right.
And it should be dark and macabre.
Well, and some of it he rethinks, like, he's like, wait, what am I doing? You know, it's like always like right before the moment he's like, you know what? This is stupid. Like, this is like way too heavy, you know?
Yeah. Or like he's going to hang himself and he ends up getting knocked off the steps he's on by his mom who's going to do laundry in the basement.
No, like she was vacuuming. So she needed the space so she could vacuum. And instead of just vacuuming the door, she's like, opens the door and pushes it open so she could back up, and he's like, you know, dangling from the extension cord.
And it
like
should be dark, but the comedic timing on it is perfect, and it'll make you laugh out loud. Yeah. It's timed so well.
Yeah, the slapstick stuff that was in it, it was there. It was very quick, and then it was over. I mean, even when he's like standing on the bridge, and you know his buddy, you know, Charles DeMar gives him a pat on the back, like, oh, buck up, little camper, you know.
You're going to be fine, little trooper.
Yeah.
He hits me, he ends up knocking him off the bridge and almost killing him, yeah.
Yeah, but then he falls into the trash can,
he falls into the garbage can. And it's got one of the great lines from a random side character. As Lane Meyer's in this trash truck being hauled away that he fell into, you see a guy cutting grass, and he's like, man, I can't believe people just throw away a perfectly good white boy.
They were linemen. They were like working on line.
Yeah,
they were in the cherry picker. And then, said, man, throwing away a perfectly good white boy like that. Yeah. You know?
It's absurd. Such a quotable movie.
Right. Yeah, there's so many quick one-liners.
Yeah, like
there's so many quick
like his neighbor Ricky, whose mom ends up, you know, accidentally blowing herself up with a cigarette and some lighter fluid.
Right.
And, you know, sorry your mom blew up, Ricky. I guess she won't be able to eat spicy food for a while.
Yeah.
Like the idea that she blew up, but she's going to be fine.
Yeah.
In this world, blowing up is like blowing up in a Looney Tunes cartoon. You're going to get better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is true. So, it is kind of, morbid and kind of weird and kind of like very strange. The comedy bits in it and the farcical stuff are just like so good.
It's all very cheery at the same time. Yeah. Like the ideas when you say them out, it sounds macabre, but nothing about the movie is really macabre at all. It's kind of,
it's because it doesn't draw attention to itself. Like once they have the gag, it's like you just move on to something else. You know,
it's a very happy film.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd call it super fun. I mean, it's a very light, fun. It makes me think of summer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such a fun film, even though it takes place over Christmas.
Yeah, it does.
Take weird. It still feels like a summer film to me.
Yeah, and I mean, and the action just kind of and kind of keeps rolling too. So
yeah, it never stops. It never lets you think about any gag too long. It doesn't have any real wasted moments.
No,
it just has funny scene after funny scene after funny scene until it's over, and it's like an hour and like 30 minutes. It's perfectly paced. I think it's damn near a classic.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
I love Better Off Dead.
I love it. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies, just because I've never actually seen, you know, a film that was able to capture the essence and capture the feeling of what it is like, not just like what happens, because there's a difference between what happens
and the feeling
and how you really feel about things and can do it in like a way. Like, so like I said, all these little gags I feel are like caricatures of the actual things,
you know, the awkward feelings of being awkward, a teenager,
but that's the way, that's how it makes you feel when you're a kid.
And that's why it works. Yeah. And that's why watching it as a now 40-year-old man, I had my birthday recently where I turned the big 40. It was fun. Thank you. It was fun to go back and see it now through old man eyes and think, it made me smile even more, because I remember feeling that way at that age and how kind of, and now I get why it's so fun now, because it's not that serious. It's all very silly to feel so weird and awkward at that age.
Right.
And you're right. Savage Steve Holland, with his script and his direction, really nails the feeling of being an awkward, lovelorn teenager.
Yeah, because I think when I watched it as a kid, like growing up when I was in like middle school and maybe barely in high school. I mean, because I probably saw it back when I was in, you know, middle school. I mean, I thought it was, you know, kind of funny, kind of amusing. But then, like, later when I saw it when I was in high school, when it played, like, on... Because it used to play on, like, HBO and stuff like that when in the late 80s. Yeah. But then after that, in the mid-90s when I was in high school, it would play on Comedy Central.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of swearing. It's not violent.
No, it's just rather silly. And so that you play it a lot on Comedy Central, matter of fact. And that's when I really, like, fell in love with it. I'm like, you know what? This movie is really... really good and really, really, you know, I just love almost every scene in it. I absolutely love.
I think if you were to poll John Cusack fans, every John Cusack fan will put it in their top 3 to 5.
Yeah. So let's move on to another movie that, you know, so because as you grow up, I mean, as everybody grows up, I mean, Matthew Broderick was in, you know, War Games and was Ferris Bueller, but I mean, he was also in other movies, you know, like he was in Election and he was in, you know,
Election,
Glory. And, you know,
Glory is such a great movie.
Yeah. You play adult characters and you have to play these other leading characters and you're not just play this teenager. I mean, Michael J. Fox, I mean, he didn't just play, you know, Marty McFly his whole life.
He wasn't Alex P. Keene. He was in Casualties of War and Secret of My Success and Doc Hollywood. They got into those older roles.
Yeah.
And John Cusack did that too.
Right. So another movie that he did that some of you may seen and some of you may not.
I certainly hadn't.
You hadn't seen it until now?
I had not seen Pushing 10 until you asked me to watch it. Yeah. I'd heard of it.
Okay.
I had not seen it.
I saw it in the 90s because this was, you know, this was at a time my buddies were watching and consuming a lot of movies because they worked at a movie store. So we're like, hey, there's a new John Cusack movie. It has Billy Bob Thornton in it. It seems rather funny. There's a lot of great cast. Yeah. We didn't know who Kate Blanchett was at the time. We barely knew who Angelina Jolie was at the time. But all these people that I mentioned are all in this movie. Are all like major characters in this movie. But the story, like I said, it's 99. John Cusack is more of a adult character, I guess. But it's at that, you know, time period, like in your 30s, where you're just like, you know, you're going from this like party time USA, like in my 20s, to like being an adult in the 30s.
Right. Now I work a 9-to-5 job where I have responsibilities and I have a family and maybe I have kids.
Yeah, that are going to school, that have real school problems. And so he plays an air traffic controller, and John Cusack is really kind of like the brainiest one, the best. Well,
it's like we were talking about earlier when we were talking about a friend about this movie. We were saying he's kind of like the hotshot air traffic controller. He's it's a silly concept, but he's like the cool one because it's John Cusack and he has that kind of vibe to him.
Right.
Like he's cool. He's cool under pressure. He seems like he's quick witted. He's got nerves of steel, and it works the film, but the idea is kind of ridiculous. But he makes it work.
Well, John Cusack, one of the things we didn't mention in Better Off Dead, because I don't think he really he kind of used it a lot. I mean, he did because when he was talking about Beth, and he has this like really sort of like nervous talk where he can talk really fast. You know, and he just has a very sort of like rapid fire, like, you know, way of speaking.
This motor mouth kind of thing.
Yeah, motor mouth. And, you know, I was always like sort of jealous because I always had a trouble like speaking and like having to stop and think of the right word. And he could just like fire it out like and just like never stop. It's like the complete run on
magic
sentence.
Of movies, man. And knowing what you're going to say ahead of time.
Well, not only that, I think that's the way. You know, part of the way John is because he does it in a lot of movies. You know what I mean? So I don't know, but in this movie, especially because he has to, you know, rapidly talk to these, you know, airplanes to try to land them. Yeah. You know, and so let's explain a little bit about, you know, the job of the air traffic controller.
It's all you.
Okay, so because of New York City is so large, you have these this intermediary that lines up all the planes so that they can all, you know, kind of land safely and not run into each other as they're all trying to approach the runway. So, because that's the last thing you want is like you got somebody coming from like the northwest and somebody coming from the southeast, and they're all trying to, you know, get to the certain point where they can line up and then turn right. Well, what if they're about to, like, you know, right at the same altitude or close to the same altitude, and then they, you know, you don't want them to run into each other.
Yeah, basically, because people would die. The right. planes would explode right. if that happened. Yeah,
and you also want to keep, because it's a very busy airspace. I mean, it's
dozens of planes an hour.
Yeah. Like 7,000 planes a day or something like that. So it's like, and then you're all trying to line them up to where they're spaced enough apart so they can, you know, one can land and clear before the other one gets there. So there's a lot of like negotiation and a lot of stress that goes on, because these are like lives at stake that you're all trying to, because there's a lot of things that they have to, placate to. And one of the other things that we didn't mention when we're doing our kind of our prep is that they mentioned quickly about the airlines themselves, you know, because they get into delays. Like if they have to like clear the way for somebody else, and then, you know, Delta can get mad and be like, well, you know, you made our guys circle, you know, a bunch of times. Like, why isn't our planes getting landed? But, you know, Northwest is, you know, getting the land like whenever they want, you know. And they have to play. They're playing to like many different, you know,
they have to
things.
Adjudicate all that. Yeah. And it seems like it'd be incredibly stressful.
Yeah, it is incredibly stressful. So, but John Cusack being the hot shot of this group, and this group being like everybody kind of does the same job.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of camaraderie that comes with like doing this job, right?
It's like any kind of like 9-to-5 situation where you all do a similar stressful job. There's certain bonding through being in those kind of high pressure jobs. Like you and I in our everyday jobs have stressful jobs, and there's certainly a bonding and a camaraderie amongst our group, and it's no different from these air traffic controllers. They're all buddies. They hang out together. They drink together. They eat meals together when they're off shift.
Mm-hmm.
They're tight. That they joke around. You know.
Well, I mean, I'll just mention we work in like an IT call center.
We do.
So it's very similar like type of job that they're doing.
Yeah.
So it's like during the time where there is work going on, everybody's like really busy, but everybody knows that everybody does the same sort of job, and there's a lot of people that need to get all this work done. So there's a lot of like, bonding that happens, you know, between all these different people that do this job. Yeah. So, and it's a really fun group. It's a really well cast movie.
There's a bunch of character actors from different roles, from different things in it.
I mean, I mentioned John Cusack, Billy Bob Thornton. Kate Blanchett plays John Cusack's wife, Connie. Angelina Jolie plays Billy Bob Thornton's wife. Jake Weber is one of the guys that also... So some people may know Jake from movies such as Dawn of the Dead and Meet Joe Black and U-571. Kurt Fuller.
Who was in Ghostbusters 2.
He was in Ghostbusters 2. He plays like the mayor's henchman in Ghostbusters 2. He was also in Wayne's World.
Yeah, Wayne's World is probably one of the movies most known for. He's in there. He's also in The Running Man.
Yep.
And he was in that great USA show, Psych.
Right. Yeah, he was in Psych too. Yeah, the TV show on USA.
He's a guy. He's definitely... Kurt Fuller is one of those guys who's definitely that guy. When you see him, you're like, oh, yeah, it's that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's the epitome of that guy.
Yeah, he's like tall, middle-aged looking
balding,
dude.
Balding, yeah. Funny, got good comedic timing, but never going to be the lead of anything.
No.
But he's good, and he's funny, and he's memorable.
Awesome support character for sure.
Yeah.
Vicki Lewis, she played Beth in News Radio TV show.
Yeah.
She was also in like the Godzilla, and she was also like a voice in Finding Nemo.
Was, yeah. She's done a lot of stuff.
Matt Ross... He was in PCU, Face Off, American Psycho, and he did the TV show American Psycho. So, yeah, and then there was also...
These are all going to be good people you recognize is what we're trying to say.
Yeah, and then there's also Mike O'Malley, guy that was on Glee TV, and also the TV movie, or the also, not the TV movie, but the movie Sully.
Yeah.
You know, another airplane movie. I mean, these were all guys like you. I looked at the cast, and I'm like, I've seen all of these people in other stuff before. I mean, and they're all really great actors. I mean, these are not, you know, just people that they hired for the show.
And it's a smart thing, this one, because the background characters don't get a lot of development.
No.
They're just kind of background dressing to John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton.
Right.
Well,
they're excellent at it. Yeah, at their bonding and the way that they talk and interact.
They do a lot with very little. Yes, the cast is easily the strongest thing about this. Everyone in the cast is great.
Right.
Filled with great actors, they do a great job.
Right, but once again, this movie is very simple.
Yeah,
John Cusack playing the hotshot. He's the guy who's like kind of the lead, like the best at what he does within their group.
Yeah.
And then Billy Bob Thornton, the new guy, comes in and he like kind of challenges that, like, you know, number one spot.
He's the new hot shot. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the new hot shot.
They even call him a cowboy at one point. You know?
Yeah, because he rides a motorcycle. He's like really sort of quiet and menacing.
He's mysterious.
Yeah.
And he's got this rock star beautiful wife played by Angelina Jolie.
Right.
Who's like half his age. And, right. You know, a little bit of trivia. This is actually the movie where they met on and began like their relationship that was so big in the tabloids through the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, he's got like this rock star kind of like quiet vibe to him. So immediately like him and Cusack butt heads because Cusack feels like he's like the rock star of this little group of people.
Right.
And it's kind of his alphaness is being challenged by Billy Bob's character.
Right. And then so what happens is John Cusack plays Nick the Zone Falzone, right?
That's a great name.
Yeah.
Nick Falzone.
Nick Falzone.
Nick the Zone Falzone.
And then...
He's always in the zone.
But what was his failure nickname? Like Nick Not in the Zone or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, Nick Not in the Zone. Yeah.
But no, he winds up like, you know, cheating on his wife with Billy Bob Thornton. Billy Bob Thornton says Russell Bell. You know, he's like... With Russell's wife.
Yeah. He runs into Mrs. Bell at the grocery store. And it's like so many like Lifetime movie kind of, you know, kind of setups where she's upset. He consoles her. And they end up sleeping together.
He's like, oh, I'll take you out to dinner. Oh, yeah. My wife is, she's off doing other things. I'll keep you company while you're sad.
It's pretty contrived. But what's
and
not.
And then they wind up, oh, let me follow you home because we had a lot of wine. Yeah. And then like. You know.
Yeah, and they sleep together. But what's not contrived is that almost immediately afterwards, she just fesses up to Billy Bob Thornton's character, Russell, about what she did.
Right.
And they don't break up. You know, they don't fight. He forgives her.
Right.
But he's mad.
Yeah.
But he's mad in a very calm way. And he goes to Nick and he goes, I know what happened. And I know I'm twice her age. I know the risk I was taking when I married a 20-year-old woman who's that beautiful.
Right.
I know the risk I was taking.
Right.
And you know what? I'm sure you understand that risk, Nick. Your wife is young and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you have those worries. It'd be a shame if something happened to your relationship like that in a very calm way.
Yeah.
And
just like I'm exacting revenge now.
And that's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to do what you did to me.
Yep.
I'm going to do back to you. I'm going to work my way into your wife's life and cause her to be unfaithful to you.
Right.
And that paranoia basically causes this character, Nick, John Cusack, who's very in control, to kind of go into a spiral of losing all control of his life. He kind of freaks out for no reason.
It shakes the pillar of his being, like the whole thing. And then especially after his marriage starts falling apart and, you know, he starts accusing her of like cheating. And she's like, wait, because somebody's cheating, you know, that means that they themselves are cheating.
Or thinking about cheating.
Right.
Yeah.
Look me in the eye and tell me you're not cheating. He can't do it. She kind of knows what's going on.
Leaves him.
Yeah. And then she's like, okay, I'm going to be at my mom's for a while. You know, it's a really sort of, you know, kind of thing. And then that's when he kind of loses his, you know, his edge at what he does. You know what I mean?
Like he almost causes a couple collisions at his job. And this is kind of interesting. I did not know if you have three collisions as an air traffic controller in 2.5 years, they pull you from the job completely and fire you.
I think it's 1.5 years. But yeah, if it's like, if you have three deals.
I thought they said 2.5 years. It was 3 and 2.5 years. It was something really severe.
Yeah.
Because you can't play with people's lives like that.
Right.
So,
and even some people go really kind of off the deep end, even if they have one, what they call one deal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like you start questioning your whole self and what you're doing.
You can't question because it can be so rapid. Yeah. And the fear of putting all those lives at risk can really shatter a person.
Right.
And it's kind of about how Nick kind of gets over his being broken by that and how he kind of reconciles with Russell. They have this bonding moment where they end up landing a bunch of planes in a storm.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell ends up leaving after that. And John Cusack's character goes and tracks down Billy Bob's character and basically asks him for forgiveness. Like, how do I...
No, because he's wrecked his life. I mean, he's just like, yeah. He's had two deals and then they send him home and then like, come back when you're ready. And it basically means that like, oh crap, like I've lost my, you know, I'm losing my wife. I may be losing my job because I'm just like, I'm right on the edge. Yeah. And so he's just like right on the edge of just like falling apart almost only because this one, you know, this one thing, like he made this choice to like, you know, kind
of a moment of weakness.
But
yeah.
I mean, I don't know, the way that his character kind of like admits that he, you know, cheat or the way, you know, when he talks to Mrs. Bell or whatever, yeah. It made it seem like this wasn't the first.
Yeah, he even said it wasn't the first time at one point in the film.
Yeah.
And that's really, to me, I'm going to talk about some of the things I didn't like about the film.
Right.
This the part with the infidelity and the relationship stuff really kind of lost me. It's because neither him or Billy Bob as Russell are very sympathetic when it comes to, you know, them talking about breaking up marriages and sleeping with each other's wives. It's not an admirable thing. And, you know, characters in movies don't have to be sympathetic, but when a movie's meant to be funny and Pushington's meant to be a comedy, it's when you add the stress of, like, there might be a plane crash at any moment on top of characters being crappy to each other, it makes it a little unpleasant.
Well, it makes you just not like you. It's like you really like, you know, Nick Falzone. From the beginning of the movie, then you start finding out more about him and what he does, and you're like, I really don't like him now.
And you find
like,
out more
you're like, oh, wait, I've been tricked. This guy isn't the guy I thought he was.
Yeah. And you start to, as you learn more about Russell, you start to like Russell more.
Yeah, and you're like, wait, I thought Russell was the, you know, the antagonist. And I really thought that, you know, when he came in, like, Nick was being really sort of, like, unfair to him at first. You know what I mean? Like, really almost challenging him. It didn't seem at all... like Russell was challenging Nick. It seemed more like Nick was challenging Russell.
And it's which in you bring up the fact that you think that Cusack's the protagonist in the beginning. I want to talk about John Cusack as an actor and the kind of characters he plays.
Right.
When he was young, was using Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer and Say Anything as kind of the archetype John Cusack young roles.
Right.
He had a plays like these sort of kind of, you know, motor mouth kind of, you know, I'm going to be persistent and get this girl. Everybody's going to work out for me, and I don't care who I have to kind of manipulate to make that happen.
Right.
I'm going to make things work out for me, kind of in a Ferris Bueller sort of way.
Right.
And John Cusack, as he's gotten older, still plays those kinds of characters. And, I mean, Nick is that kind of character. The character in High Fidelity is that kind of character. But as you get older, the perception of what that actually means in real life changes. And when you're a teenager, it seems kind of admirable to be that persistent and to be that in control.
Right.
But as you get older, you realize, well, he's kind of a D-bag.
Yeah. I mean, I know that every character is going to have flaws.
Yeah.
And you want to see that character overcome those flaws in the end. But one of the things you don't want to have happen is that you don't want to, you know, believe that this person is this type of person, and then really they're this type of person. You know what I mean?
And Pushington really kind of skirts that. And what saves it is that John Cusack's character, Nick, does have a redemption arc. Like, he goes to Russell, and they basically make amends.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically changes his ways. He gets his wife back. They have a happy ending because he's basically apologized and repented for the shitty things he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon my swearing, but yeah. So he seeks forgiveness,
right?
And tries to be a better person. He grows.
Yeah, he does have growth.
Yeah,
I just don't think the ending like had a lot of growth, and it was just like it was hard to see, you know, that sort of thing, like him go through that transformation. I mean, it's almost like the transformation was at the end, and it was like so fast and so
really
quickly, and it was just like it was over and before it started. You know what I mean?
Well, but what makes the movie worthwhile, and I think Pushington is worthwhile, is from the performances of Billy Bob and John.
Yeah, their interplay was really, really great.
Yeah, it's fun that they've got chemistry. It's fun to watch them bounce off each other because they have two very different energies.
Yeah.
Like, again, kind of John Cusack's kind of rapid, and Motormouth, and Billy Bob's kind of lackadaisical and Southern.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like they would be in the same movie. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
And their energies are fun to watch play off each other, and that's what makes the movie work. That plus you have a very beautiful Cate Blanchett who's great.
Yeah, and this is a very early Cate Blanchett, and a very before beautiful, we got to know her in other movies like The Aviator and you know, Lord of the Rings and all that stuff. Yeah.
And a very beautiful and very charming Angelina Jolie when she was like 20, maybe 22, 23.
Way before she was Lara Croft or, you know, any of that stuff.
Really early in her career. And then you have these wonderful supporting characters around them. So really the cast elevates the movie so much. It makes it worth seeing.
And I love Angelina Jolie's accent in this movie.
Yeah.
It's so fantastic. It's like this, you know, kind of Texas, you know, sort of accent that's just charming.
I don't know if it's realistic, but you're right. It is charming. It's fun to hear. It's fun to listen to her.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
So I didn't love Pushington, but like I said, but the cast, again, we'll watch them play off each other. Mm-hmm. Makes it worth watching for sure.
Yeah, and I love movies that give us some insight into like these other professions that we didn't know that are like so odd and so different. You know?
Yeah, I almost forgot. That's actually, to me, I think that's the second best thing about this movie. Yeah. I didn't know anything about air traffic controllers, and now I feel like I know a lot.
Yeah, there was a little bit about like stress in the movie, like Summer Rental, because John Candy's character, he plays an air traffic controller.
You're right.
And the beginning scene, you know, he's at home, and he's like having all these like very sort of like everyday like home things, you know, just trying to get out of the house. And then he gets to work, and, you know, he's trying to, like, land a plane. He's like, where are you? Where are you? I don't see you. Where are you? And then, like, the supervisor comes by, and he, like, flips a fly off his, you know, screen. And he's like, you know, you lost your touch, man. You need to, you know, take some time off. You know, take the kids down to, you know, to the beach or something. And that's how that whole movie starts.
Yeah. And Pushing 10 takes that idea and sprinkles things like that throughout the movie to give you an idea of what it would be like to be an air traffic controller. And to me, that's some of the most interesting stuff about it, is to see how that world works.
Yeah,
it's not really a world that your average person is going to know anything about. I certainly didn't know anything about air traffic controlling.
Right.
And it was kind of mind-blowing to me to see how detailed and involved it is. And the movie is very good with jargon. Mm-hmm. The technology seems all very plausible and realistic. I don't know how true to life it is, but it seems very real.
Yeah.
And that part's really interesting.
No, the stuff that they use about, like, the jargon that they use, like, you know, you're going down the pipes. You know, that's when the guy's, like, losing his edge, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, all of those things are, you know, are like, that's my airspace. You know, these are all, like, like real terms that they're
Even the name using. Of the movie, Pushing 10, it means getting the planes in quickly.
Yeah, like you're pushing, like you're actually directing the planes, pushing the tin, you know, because the airplanes are made out of aluminum. You're pushing them around, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
You're getting them down the line, so to speak. Yeah.
What's weird is like some international people didn't understand that terminology. Yeah. And a lot of people don't know what that means, you know what I mean?
I didn't until I watched the movie, for sure.
No. And that's not what all the movie's about either, you know?
But that stuff makes it interesting. I mean, that's one of the merits of the film, I think. That and the cast, for sure, are what make Pushing 10 worth seeing.
Yeah, and make sure it's Pushing 10, T-I-N.
T-I-N, yeah, like a tin cup. Yeah. But not tin cup with Kevin Costner.
No.
And we should say that Pushing 10 was directed by a director by the name of Mike Newell.
Yeah, Mike Newell, produced by Art Linson. Yeah. And so, yeah, did you have something to say about Mike Newell?
You see, I did, but I completely blanked out. I'm going to give you one moment. I want to pull up his filmography. I know he directed some other noteworthy things.
Okay.
Give me one sec.
He
directed Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he directed Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Oh, wow, okay.
So he's had a pretty... Yeah.
He's got some nerd cred.
He does, yeah. And, he did... That's why I was going to mention Mike Newell. He directed Donnie Brasco, which is one of the few really good Johnny Depp movies. I know Johnny Depp's kind of, you know, persona non grata nowadays, but I mean,
he's one of those guys. I mean, to me, a lot of people like love his work. To me, I think, you know, he's hit or miss, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah, he directed Donnie Brasco, great film. So yeah, Mike Newell is a director, and the movie is actually it's a very well directed movie.
Yeah.
It's got interesting visual flourishes.
Yeah. It's also a movie that doesn't have a lot of fluff. Everything moves kind of quickly.
Yeah.
Everything, all the storylines make like complete sense. The only time it really, I think, falls apart is just kind of near the end.
Yeah.
When Nick kind of loses it and then how he brings it all together. It just seems rather very sort of Hollywood ending,
yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like, oh, yeah, we got to wrap this up. We got 20 minutes left. Yeah. But, yeah, that's pushing 10.
Yeah, it's pushing 10. That's it. So, should we go through the, keep it for a day? Keep it for an extra day?
Oh, yeah, let's as we always do on Video Culture, if you were to rent Better Off Dead from the video store, would you get it back early or would you keep it an extra day and pay those late fees?
I am going to keep this movie forever.
Yeah, I would steal it and just I would lie and say I returned it to try to get it. I'm happy to pay for it, but I'd want to keep it forever.
Or make a copy and then give them the copy.
Yeah, like I think Better Off Dead is a damn near perfect cult movie.
Yeah.
I said earlier, I love it to death.
I love it. And then Pushing 10, I mean, I think it's good for a watch, but I'm going to return it.
I would get it in on time.
Back on time. I'm not going to pay extra late.
I'm glad I saw it so I could learn about this world of air traffic controllers. And as a man, it was fun to see young Angelina Jolie. I'm going to be a little bit gross and say it was fun to see young Angelina Jolie.
Let's just say there's a slight bit of nudity scene,
which I appreciated.
Rated R movie.
Yeah, we should mention that, rated R. So I appreciated that. I'm going to be a little shallow and say I appreciated that. Forgive me, Video Culture audience.
Right.
So, but yeah.
Spoiler alert.
And I honestly really like the interplay between Billy Bob and John. Mm. I enjoyed it. I will not watch it again.
Right. Yeah, I think if they had some other sort of competition between them. Besides just like the wives or something like that, I think that would have been a lot more interesting when they brought that in and the infidelity.
I'm gonna take
your wife on the table. Yeah, and I just thought that's just it's too low down of that character to do. They could have played off each other a lot better.
Could have been more of a professional rivalry, and I think it'd been more fun and interesting.
Yeah, where he kind of lost his edge for something else.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, so. Let's go through the facts, shall we?
Hit me.
All right, so Better Off Dead, we already said directed by Steve Holland.
Savage Steve Holland.
You got to say the whole thing. Sorry, Steve. Sorry, Savage Steve Holland. He studied animation at the California Institute of the Arts. Okay, so, I mean, his background, he went to film school to study animation. So it makes sense to me why there's these, like, really fantastic sort of like stop motion or like animated scenes or these like interplay between the main character and the character that's drawing on the thing. I thought that, nobody else has done that in a film I've ever seen. And if they've ever done it, they've ripped it off of Savage Steve Holland.
Not a lot for sure.
No.
And he has gone on to have a pretty big career in animation. He's very well known for the popular animated series from the 90s called Eek the Cat. Which again is a cult cartoon series among 90s kids.
Here's another bit of trivia for you. He created the animated Whammy on the game show Press Your Luck.
No whammies, no whammies. Stop.
No whammies. Did you know that?
I did not. But it looks like his art when you go back and look at the stuff he's drawn. It looks like his stuff. And I loved Press Your Luck as a kid.
I love Press Your Luck. I love that movie.
They brought it back.
Yeah.
When this airs, it may still not be on the air anymore. But at the moment we're recording this, Press Your Luck is back on TV. So it's been fun to see it again.
Was it Chuck Woolery that did Press Your Luck?
I think it was Chuck Woolery, which we're not going to talk about him because he's another guy who's kind of gone crazy in his old age. But I love Pressure because I love the whammy concept. I love the no whammy stop. But that was Savage Steve.
Right, and he still directs shows for Disney Channel and Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
So.
A lot of children's material, yeah.
He was discovered by Henry Winkler. Henry saw one of his animated shorts. Well, Henry is like, he's known for one of like the nicest guy in Hollywood. Before Steve Carell, there was Henry Winkler, right, as the nicest guy. And Henry's still around and we love him. He's still a really great, nice guy. And so is Steve Carell. But Henry saw one of his animated shorts at the Los Angeles Film Festival. So after it, he said, well, hey, I want to take you to lunch. I want to, talk to you. And he said, I believe in you and your twisted vision and I want to give you an office. So he didn't really have anything for him or like what he could do. But he's like, let me at least give you some of my, you know, clout and let me give you a place to like create and come up with something on your own to try to give you your own thing, because that's a big thing about Hollywood is having an office where you can meet people and make calls and, you know, because working out of your house apparently in LA like doesn't work. So the movie is also based upon like some twisted true stories that actually that Steve Holland actually, you know, experienced himself.
Oh, yeah.
So his high school girlfriend really did leave him for the captain of the ski team.
So he's working out some personal demons, really.
Yes, he is. And actually, matter of fact, he said in an interview that, you know, after the movie like came out, like he said a few years later that he gets a call from her and like profusely apologizing and basically said that she's been in therapy for like 3 years. You know, because of all this. That's, I know.
It's weirdly absurd.
Right.
But, because I'm more weirded out by the fact that the high school skiing team was a real thing.
Yeah, it really is a thing.
As a kid who grew up in the South in flyover states, it's so wild to me.
Yeah. But no, what I think is funny is like, I don't know if her real name was Beth, but she apparently like, you know, lost a lot of sleep over it after seeing the film and was just like, oh my gosh, I did not know that this had such a profound effect on him. And they really bothered him. Exactly. So anyway, he did actually said that he almost tried to like hang himself with a pipe, like the scene where he's got the, that we talked about, like the extension cord around his neck and he hung it around a pipe. And then he was like, he was standing on a trash can, he said, but a plastic trash can, and he thought, you know, this is stupid. And right about the time he thought that, the plastic trash can like gave way because it's like plastic, and then he kind of fell, and it didn't really. He said it didn't really do anything, but it broke the pipe, and then he said his mom got mad at him for breaking the pipe. Not that he tried to like kill himself, but she was like, "What are you doing?" Like, I think that he probably tried to play it off like he was trying to pull some stupid prank or do something stupid. Yeah. So, and then he also said that his mom tried to make recipes out of McCall's magazine and also once gave him TV dinners as a present.
So that was,
real. Like, he was like, oh, you like the peach cobbler. And this
there's a scene in them that we didn't mention earlier, but one of the absurd things is Lynn Meyer's mom on Christmas gives him a bunch of TV dinners for a Christmas present.
Yeah, they're all individually wrapped, too. Yeah. It wasn't like a whole bunch of them, and he wraps them. Like, no, they're individually wrapped, and he wraps them. Oh, okay. Beef stroganoff. Like, so
his mom actually did that. That's wild.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah and the scene where, and she's like, oh, yeah, you like the peach cobbler in this one. Apparently, that was like a real thing. Like, that really happened. So, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing that Savage Steve Holland said is that his film that he makes were, they were almost supposed to be depressing, you know, but it wound up making people laugh. And so he just kind of like went with it. You know what I mean?
He can't help but have that animator's kind of cartoonist quality about his work.
Yeah.
And it's so charming.
Yeah. So, but moving on, since this episode is about John Cusack. And this is a sad part, and I have to say this because everything that I looked at, not just on one source, but many sources confirmed this, okay, that John Cusack originally hated the movie.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me earlier, and I had never heard that before, and it shocked me to hear that he doesn't like it.
Right. So, he said, you know, he felt like he was tricked by Savage Steve Holland. And he said it was the worst thing he'd ever seen. And he thought he'd been used by, you know, Savage Steve. And he thought he'd been made to look like a fool, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know what motivated this. Even Steve, you know, Savage Steve said he had a hard time kind of explaining, like, sort of John's sort of holdbacks. Because it's like, how do you not make a movie and know what it's about? How do you not read the script or, like, I mean, you're in most of the scenes in the movie. He's in almost every scene.
I think he is in every. Well, no way, you're right. There's like maybe three scenes he's not in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how do you not, you know, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And like maybe he just didn't understand it, and he didn't feel confident to ask about it.
Yeah.
But it's clear that he doesn't get the movie.
Hmm.
To me, it's clear that the
I don't know if he doesn't really understand it, or maybe he felt like because it didn't do well, maybe he was trying to distance himself from the movie.
Could be.
Like, oh, that's just a stupid movie I did because it didn't have a lot of commercial success.
Yeah.
You know, so it might have been something that he said, but, you know, then because, you know, like in Hollywood, yeah, it's like you're only as good as the last thing you
do. And you often have to distance yourself from those flops you have.
Right.
But time, of course, has been very, very kind to Better Off Dead.
Right.
And to me, like I said, it's the epitome of the kind of movie that we talk about on this show.
Right. And actually, what's funny is that Savage Steve Holland fought to have John Cusack in the movie after seeing the movie The Sure Thing. And so he saw him,
Another great one.
He saw him in 16 Candles, and then he was just like, you know, saw him in The Sure Thing, and he told the studio, he said, this is a guy that's on the cusp of being a leading man. You know, he's kind of like, you know, Anthony Michael Hall, you know, that was in, Weird Science, you know, about the same time. That was like, what, 85 or something like that, about the same time.
You mean Gotcha's Anthony Michael Hall?
Yeah. I mean, that was what, 80,
little like, callback to our one of our previous episodes.
But yeah, but what I'm saying is because, you know, they're anyway. Moving on. But yeah, he fought because he was like, you're getting a deal because this is guy's on the cusp. He's on the leading edge, and this guy could really nail it for what he wanted to do and what his vision was.
And he did.
Yeah.
It's just a shame that Cusack doesn't like the films because I think that and the other film we did with Savage Steve Holland are some of his very best movies and some of my favorite John Cusack movies.
Yeah, I mean, he was apparently John Cusack was already under contract to do, One Crazy Summer. But yeah, apparently after that, the relationship between, he did the movie because he was contractually obligated. But yeah, he because he couldn't get out, like it would be too financially detrimental to get out of it. And then apparently John also did not used to sign Better Off Dead items. So if somebody brought like something for him to sign, DVD or Laserdisc or lobby card or something, he wouldn't sign them. Like a poster, he wouldn't do it. But Curtis Armstrong has recently said, I think on the Nerdist podcast that in 2014, he did see him sign a Better Off Dead poster.
I think over time, actors get a little more chill about the work they did in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they rose-colored glasses and all that.
Right. Yeah, it's like, what's it going to hurt for this person who really loves this movie now?
Exactly.
Like, you know what I mean?
It doesn't matter what I think about it. As long as the people who are my fans like it, you know?
Right, exactly. The same sort of thing about, what's... Star Trek.
Shatner or Nimoy?
William Shatner.
Yeah. Well, him and Nimoy both were very anti-Star Trek for years and years.
Right, yeah.
And
I can't believe it. Yeah,
and they came back around on it. It's okay, man. You get the microphones in front of you. You get into these hot lights of the podcast room.
I'm going to cool off.
These hot Tennessee days.
And the pressure. Well, I mean, it's context. I mean, I'm not thinking all these things right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, that same sort of thing where you're not really in love, like, you know, because, you know, you're seen as the character. Like, he was afraid of being seen as Lane Meyer, not as John Cusack.
That's probably what it was for sure. He was afraid of being typecast as, like, a teen actor. Like, kind of like what honestly happened to Anthony Michael Hall for a while.
Right. Well, recently in 2019, John Cusack has been appearing in cities across the U.S., in a speaking engagement tour, but only speaking on three movies, High Fidelity, Say Anything, and Gross Point Blank. So he's been going to cities, and he'll go to like a different city, and he'll talk like Atlanta.
He came to Nashville?
No, he's coming to Nashville.
Oh, I thought...
Not yet. No. Well, by the time this podcast probably airs, yes.
Yeah.
November 2nd, he will be in Nashville, or was in Nashville. But he's only talking about Say Anything?
Yeah, and I thought about going, but it's way too expensive.
It is. But that's the thing. I mean, it's kind of like a talk, and it's kind of like a – and then there's also like a big Q&A too. So it's different from a DVD commentary where you just get like talk about the movie or like whatever. This, you actually have like an interactive experience.
Yeah. I wonder how often he gets asked for $2 in Q&As.
Oh.
That's why that may be what he hates it right there.
Maybe why.
Yeah.
$2 But yeah, I mean, but going back to one thing I failed to mention about Better Off Dead, all the jokes, you know, how completely serious they are and how completely perfect. Even the pull-away scene where they're like at Dodger Stadium, you know, and they're like, yeah, you know, it's with fa- the, it's with the Camaro.
Fade to black.
Yeah, yeah, fade to black. The, you know, the shot you can tell is from a helicopter and it's fading away and you see the L.A. skyline in the background and here comes the little kid on his BMX bike, like wanting $2. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's absolutely perfect. Anyway, so so here's another funny story. Aaron, the guy that played the captain in the ski team, his actor's name is Aaron Dozier. So apparently when he showed up on set, he insulted Savage Steve Holland when he auditioned. Or not when he showed up on set, but when he auditioned. So apparently he said, when I came in, I didn't know who Savage Steve was at first. So I looked at one guy and said, who's this chubby kid? And turns out it was Steve. And so Steve's version of the story, he's like, this pompous jerk comes in and say, hey, who's the fat surfer? And I'm like, wow, who is this? This guy is perfect. You got the part. You know, he's just like, you know, because here he is like, you know, being insulting, pompous and insulting.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. So yeah, so I thought that was like really funny.
That's funny, yeah.
Yook Sun Ree, that's the guy who plays the Howard Cosell, like speaking,
the antagonist from Karate Kid Part 2.
Right. So he actually did a lot of preparation for the movie to sound like Howard Cosell with an Asian accent. So he's like, oh, they want me to play this character that sounds like Howard Cosell. Well, all right. So he really did, like, I mean, he could speak like normal, you know, English, but he was like, okay, I'm going to study Howard Cosell so I can sound like him and all this stuff. And then when he shows up on set to do, you know, to do the stuff, they were like, oh no, we're going to overdub you with Rich Little. So what you hear in the movie is not actually him.
Oh, it's actually Rich Little.
It's actually Rich Little, yes. And he actually had a good attitude about it. He said, well, you know, whatever they want to do, you know.
He's still a pretty big part of the film.
Right.
And he's had a good career. I mean, he's done a lot of TV work.
Right. But yeah, it's one of those things where I was like, well, it's not my call. It's their it's their movie, and you know, I'm just a part of it.
That's really the best working actors have that mentality. Right. It's a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, how is he going to be like, well, it's my artistic vision that you're going to keep my voice.
But I sound like Howard Cosell in this movie.
And I did all this prep, and you're going to keep me in this movie.
Don't dub me with the O's. Obviously, a bigger star at the time. Yeah.
Right, because it's those kind of guys that make all these demands that don't wind up, you know, getting called back. You know. Yeah. Okay, so the Chevy Camaro, because I'm a car guy.
Chevy Camaro from Better Off Dead, which we didn't really mention too much, but yeah.
No, it is almost like another character, you know, in the movie.
It's a beautiful car.
It's a 1967 SS model. It actually belonged to the transportation captain of the film. In 2002, a man in Florida hired a private investigator to track down the car, and it wound up the guy who was the transportation captain. He kind of restored it, and then his son drove it for a little while, and then his son sold it to another guy. So it was still in California. Because the son sold it, he's like, I don't know where it is. So the guy in Florida who really wanted it was like, I got to have this car. I mean, he paid for a private eye to track it down. Finally tracked it down to another guy who had it, and he wasn't really doing anything with it. And he's like, yeah, I've kind of lost, lost interest in it. And he's, you know, so he flew out there and bought it, had it shipped to him in Florida. And this dude in Florida had it totally restored. It didn't have the original engine. But yeah, from the ground up.
Yeah, but still, he's got the car from Better Off Dead. And when you're a kid and you watch these movies and you fall in love with something like that, you get older, you can have the money to have it. You know, if I had the kind of money where I could buy my dream car, I would totally have like the Trans Am from Smokey and the Bandit. You know,
right, right. You know, because this one, I mean, there was a lot of like General Lee's, you know, and a lot of different. I mean, and people have made like General Lee cars because you know, take a Dodge Charger and, you know, paint it orange. Yeah. And,
but to have the car from Better Off Dead or some movie like that, that's really cool because it's something that, that fans are going to appreciate,
right?
Especially if you love the movie. Right. And there's not a gazillion copies out there.
No. So he actually had a website at one time, but as, you know, the internet is so expensive to keep up with these days, to keep up even just buying your URL for $10 a year, or however much it is, and hosting, the price of hosting the way that it is now, because we have to keep everything so secure.
We're trying to say, if you want to send us some money, guys, we gotta keep our lights on. So.
You can look up on like archive.com on the Wayback Machine. You can look up betteroffdeadcamaro.com, and you can kind of see some pictures of it. There's some stuff. You will need Flash installed to kind of see it, but
which for the time being still works, you internet nerds.
And it will tell you like more detail. The actual story is there. The guy wrote that's still up there on the archive.com. So if you're really interested in reading the whole story, go check it out. It's really cool. So, and it still may be seen in car shows. I mean, the guy still has it and will bring it out for certain car shows every now and again.
Well, in the film, it's a beautiful car.
The budget, we don't know what the budget is. This was one of those times of the year, like, they didn't report what the budget was for the movie. All I know is that Savage Steve Holland actually came in under budget. That's all I
can
really tell.
And it still failed financially.
They only made $10.3 million.
Yeah.
So I would guess this movie probably was made for about $30 million. Maybe less.
Probably less.
Probably 15.
Yeah, probably 15.
Yeah.
You still have a few things you would need that would be expensive, like stunt work and
Stuntmen, and like they had to get that mountain.
Stunt skiers are pretty impressive.
Yeah, the helicopter scene.
And you have the guy falling off the bridge into the truck, you know, and stuff like that. Right. I mean, there's a few explosions. That stuff's not cheap.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of that animation, you know.
Animation's expensive.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, Savage Steve Holland didn't do it all himself. Yeah. He probably had a lot of art direction in it. Probably did a lot of, you know, some stuff himself, but yeah, there was another party involved in that whole scene too. Okay, so Roger Ebert, he didn't really have anything to write about this, but he didn't, you know, he wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he did not write about this movie in the Chicago Sun-Times, okay? So
it didn't have much of a blip when it came out.
No. He did, however, it was featured in the Roger and Ebert, Gene Siskel show at the movies.
Oh, Siskel and Ebert at the movies, yeah.
Siskel and Ebert at the movies. And they gave it 2 thumbs down. But that just shows you, I mean, They didn't really get it. They didn't really identify with it. They didn't get the vision.
It's very unique. Mm-hmm. It's like a UHF, man. It's probably closest cinematic brethren is Weird Al's UHF. And that's another movie that critics did not get, and it was a financial flop.
Right. Office Space is probably another one that's like that, too.
Yeah, and they are very great, funny movies.
Yeah.
And so, like, as I've said it many times, as I am a pro film critic and a film journalist, we're not right all the time.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, we all have biases and bad days, and we make bad calls sometimes. Right. So, you know, time is the best critic.
Well, time will tell. And Rotten Tomatoes, the thing I love about Rotten Tomatoes, and one of the reasons that we mention Rotten Tomatoes on the show, is that there are modern film critics that attribute to the critic's score. So even if a movie, you know, does bad initially, if it's had, like, you know, better stuff, you know, now, like, it's a very more beloved movie now than it was back then. Like, now it's had a lot of cult, you know, kind of success or kind of a cult classic, then that critic score will reflect that.
It'll actually raise.
Right. So Rotten Tomatoes critic score, 76%. And the audience score is 87%.
Which is really good considering how kind of oddball the movie is. It's an odd little movie.
It is an odd movie, but I was really glad when I looked at Rotten Tomatoes and I said, yes, the audience, 87% is a huge score for audience for that movie. I mean, that means that they, like me, identified it and, you know, loved it, you know, as much as I do. Really.
Yeah, again, time is the best critic.
So moving on to Pushing 10. The word you mentioned, they mentioned in the show Tracon. I don't know if you remember that in the movie.
I do. They mentioned Tracon a few times.
Yeah. Okay. It actually stands for Terminal Radar Approach Controls. So like we're mentioning in the movie, there are certain cities like New York City that have a really busy airspace. So the way that they do takeoff is that, you know, most cities, like say Bozeman, Montana, for example, they will just have, you know, the control tower, you know, they'll control the airspace up until they get to a certain feet. And then once they're there, then somebody else takes over for the remainder of the flight until they get to the airport. So the local airport just basically takes care of, you know, approach and departure, right? But when you have such a busy airspace like New York City, like Chicago, like Atlanta, you have these Tracon, and what they do is they're an intermediary. So like right before, you know, on approach or departure, once they get to a certain, you know, altitude, they'll get handed off to Tracon. And they'll kind of guide them out of the airspace once they kind of leave the airport, you know, airspace. And then once they get to a certain altitude, then they're passed over to the, you know, the remainder of the flight, most of the flight to the other, you know, the other controllers. So that's what these guys do. That's why they're pushing 10, because they're really kind of controlling the busy lanes, you know, of like multiple airports, not just one airport, but like five airports, you know.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. We try to be entertaining and informative.
All right. So Billy Bob Thornton character Russell Bell states that in the movie he is half Irish and half Choctaw Indian. In real life, Bob Thornton's father is of Irish ancestry and his mother is half Choctaw Indian and half Italian.
Hmm.
So he's, I guess, like a quarter Choctaw technically.
Yeah.
You know. So, not far off from the actual truth.
Interesting.
Yeah, Billy, you mentioned Billy Bob Thornton and Angelina Jolie first met on the set of this movie. They fell in love and were briefly married.
Had that lucky, lucky man.
And then they were like, had a divorce. Like,
yeah, I actually read an interview recently because of Pushing 10 where Billy Bob talked about it. And he said really the reason they divorced was because he feels like he's not really into going out and playing a celebrity. He likes to kind of stay home and live a quiet life. And she really wanted to go out and be like out amongst celebrities and be in the social life of being a celebrity. And he said, you know, that just wasn't for him. And he thinks that's why they split up. And they still talk to each other. They still have a very positive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why they're not together anymore. Was they just really wanted two different things out of life.
Yeah, they had a very like kindred relationship. I mean, they were almost inseparable for like a really.
And it was really high profile for a long time. I think because people couldn't wrap their mind around why this beautiful woman wanted to date a guy who really. And Billy Bob Thornton, if you're listening, I love you as an actor, but this guy who looked a lot like Barney Fife.
yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's just Billy Bob Thornton plays a lot of the character. I mean, he really is like. You know, very sort of mysterious, you know, himself.
Yeah, he's got a certain charisma for sure.
Right. I mean, he's a musician. He's an actor. I mean, he drives a motorcycle.
Have you ever heard his music? It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I love his stuff. It's very like that Americana, you know, stuff that he does. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's very, very cool. I mean, and I know he doesn't like in interviews to really even talk about it or ask about it. He doesn't even... because really, I know to him, his personal life is his personal life. Yeah. His professional life is his professional
life. Which I appreciate as a guy who has to write a lot about, you know, celebrity stuff, you know.
Right. Angelina Jolie had just shaved her head for the dying scenes in the movie Gia right before Pushing 10. So she wore a wig like in the whole movie.
Really?
That's not her real hair.
You can't tell.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Hollywood, man. It's like, you know.
Yeah, like expensive
the best stylists
wigs.
In the
yeah.
world, you know?
Yeah.
These are stylists that, like, win, you know, Academy yeah. Awards, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. That was a silly statement. But, yeah, it's an impressive wig because I had no idea. That, to me, is the most surprising thing you've said so far.
All right. Movie magic, my friend. Movie magic.
Movie magic.
When Russell Bell stands on the runway, here's another bit of fact, okay? I had to look this up because I was like, there's no way. There is a scene where they stand behind a landing 747.
And let the updraft, like, lift them and throw them.
Yeah, and so, okay. So, this is what somebody said, and I want to read this verbatim because somebody actually wrote this on IMDb, okay? And it makes sense, but it's a lot of, like, a lot of little jargon, and maybe I can try to help break it down. And he says, wingtip vortices, I mean, he's using a word like vortices, right? Roll off the tips of wings in a swirling motion and travel outward and downward. In reality, one would need to be positioned several feet outboard of the wingtips to feel the effect. Farther if the airplane were higher. However, if a strong crosswind were to exist, in this instance from the right, it would cause a vortex to persist on the runway for an extended period of time. If strong enough, the vortex can be blown laterally across the runway towards the center line where Mr. Thornton's character was standing. Of course, the landing altitude of the aircraft depicted that the movie did not indicate such a crosswind. However, the concept is not wholly impossible as implied by the aforementioned.
So after all that, I just kind of want to channel Ogre from Revenge of the Nerds and just scream, nerd! But no, that's interesting. But just really detailed.
Right, because you can, like, any plane landing in a crosswind is like, you know, it's almost like it's crooked. So you can tell if a plane's landing in a crosswind or not, and that's what he's basically saying. It's like, if there's a crosswind, then there's a possibility, but the plane really wasn't landing in the crosswind. So, but it's not out of the realms of, like, what can't happen. But what he's also trying to say is that doesn't happen at every landing. It's not like you can just stand behind the plane and then, like, be blown to the side.
Are you saying movies lie to us, Ryan?
And also, let's just not, you know, for the sake of, like, reality or suspending our disbelief, that you can just go out to the airport whenever you want and go stand at the end of the runway while planes land. You know, not that you can't get on the premises or there's security cameras, like, pointed towards the runway, that sort of thing. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, this was made in 1999, like, before 2001.
Before 9/11,
But, but still, I mean, airport security around the perimeter was still about the same. So,
still a thing,
So, yeah, let's just you know, suspend ourselves from that reality, right?
Again, that's a different kind of movie magic.
All right. And then just moving on, I mean, I didn't really find any other, like, facts about it other than the movie is based upon this article that was written in around 1996, called in the New York Times Magazine, called Something's Got to Give by Darcy Frey. So you can go and look at it. If you just Google it from the New York Times, it's still readable. You can read the whole article. But it actually mentions a lot of the some of the things in the movie about the nicknames they give to people that don't actually come back or kind of lose their marbles or kind of
basically the details about the job all come from that article.
Yeah,
right?
Like even she talks about the guy called Dr. Freeze that did that. You know, like he just froze up.
He gets panicked and can't do it anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah, where he's just like he didn't know what to do. He was just like there was too much stuff going on, so he just became, you know, catatonic and you know, they can't have that. I mean, it's just too dangerous of a job for that to happen.
I'm sure it happens a lot.
Right. No, there was one guy that they said, I read the article, and there was one guy that was like, he had too many planes, and then they asked for one more plane to come in, and he just got, like, totally lost. He just, like, deleted off the blips off his screen and just, like, walked out.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm it. I'm done. And was just, you know. So, yeah, it's just
scary to think about.
Yeah. So the stress is real. The stuff in there, the jargon is real. You read the article. It's really informative. It's really good.
And just one more time, go ahead and give the name and where they can read it at.
So it's called Something's Got to Give from the New York Times Magazine.
So Google that, guys. It's pretty interesting.
By Darcy Frey.
Darcy Frey.
D-A-R-C-Y-F-R-E-Y. Yeah, it's a really fantastic article. But yeah, that was like kind of the inspiration for the movie. And I mean, it didn't mention anything about like, you know, sleeping with each other's wives or whatever. But yeah, the more about the job.
So really, all the interesting stuff from the movie. Came from the
actual
article.
Good part about the movie. Yeah.
So, so I think that brings us now to the close of our show, which
Wait! I got like two
or
three
more.
Okay,
there. Okay.
It opened number. I just wanted to talk a little bit more before we talk about the box office and what Roger Ebert said about it and stuff. It opened number 4 at the box office. It grossed $8.4 million. But it did not make up for its estimated production budget of $33 million.
I don't know what costs. I guess there's a lot of CGI with the planes.
There's a lot of CGI. All of that, you know, those sets, those, you know, radar stuff and the create, all that stuff.
And at that time, that would have been expensive in
there's
99.
There's all the plane stuff that they had to do to recreate all of that stuff.
I guess that would be expensive.
Roger, Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars. 3 out of 4.
I could see that. I mean, I could see someone responding to it that way because it's not bad. There's a lot of good stuff in it.
And you know what's interesting is that you didn't read Roger Ebert's comments before this, did you?
No.
He said almost exactly what you said.
Oh, really? Cool.
The movie is worth seeing for the good stuff. I'm recommending it because of the performance of the details in the air traffic control center, where the job description includes depression, nervous breakdowns, heart attacks, and hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
And then, this is the best part, he says, the director Mike Newell, he said he has a gift in making his characters come alive so that it actually underlines the weakness of the ending.
He was really good at stating things.
Yeah, I mean, he basically said the same thing. The cast is, like, the best part, and, like, the, you know, the thing about, like, you know, the job and everything was also the greatest part about it. And that's why it's worth seeing.
Again, and it's so good. It really highlights what's wrong with it, too, though.
Yeah, and the ending sucked, you know, basically. Yeah. Yeah, to put it mildly. Or to put it bluntly. Sorry, not mildly. All right, Rotten Tomatoes, 48% critics, 42% audience.
Sounds about right.
Really? You think so?
I would think so, yeah. Because it's just kind of there, you know? Mm-hmm. There's the good and bad almost cancel it out, you know?
Yeah, it's not like I go running to the people and be like, have you seen this movie?
Yeah, I'm sure air traffic controllers love it.
Yeah, or they may hate it because it's not real, you know, it's not reality.
I don't have Angelina Jolie in my life, darn it. Where's my Cate Blanchett?
But they would never do that, or why would they do, you know what I mean?
We just laughed.
Yeah, all right, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they made so many
mistakes.
Right, exactly. But I think that there's enough truth in there. I mean, I know it's not entirely true, but I mean, I think it's enough truth about the camaraderie of that job.
Yeah, it's enough where you can get like a little fun crash course and taste in it. Yeah.
The film was actually nominated for Best Casting in a Feature Comedy by the Casting Society of America.
I didn't know it was a thing, but that's cool.
Apparently it is, and apparently we talked about the great cast, and you know, somebody else, you know, the Casting Society of America also agreed. And was nominated for Best Sound Editing by the Motion Picture Sound Editors. Now, I don't know why the sound was that great. I mean, maybe because there was a lot of planes.
There's a lot of ambient noise when they're in the control center. It's
Yeah, I guess so. But there was a lot of plane noise. I really liked how when they were at, like, the guy's house, you know, at the backyard barbecue, and you can hear planes, like,
and it would actually drown out the dialogue in realistic ways. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you can hear planes like flying overhead. Yeah. You know what I mean? That was great.
So, yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like they chose that location on purpose.
Yeah. To give an idea of, like, you know, to these characters really live in this world, even when they're not doing the job.
Right. Yeah.
So as I was saying earlier, I think that brings us to the end of our show,
right?
Which means recommendations. So do you have any recommendations for us today, Ryan?
Recommendations. I mean, you can almost like put in any like any John Cusack film, you know, and put it in and put it in place. I think One Crazy Summer is an awesome, awesome follow-up, you know, to Better Off Dead. And if you want more of that, then that is definitely where to go. And I think it almost plays like a sequel, almost.
Yes.
And it is almost, you know, as good, you know?
It's a little bit weaker in places, but it's still a great movie, and it carries that vibe well. It'd make a great double feature, you know?
Right.
We almost did that as the double feature this time, but we wanted to show more range in Cusack's career.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, that's a great choice. I'm going to recommend a movie that from even later in Cusack's career.
Okay.
That he did in the mid-2000s.
Okay.
He stars with Elijah Wood.
Right.
It's called Grand Piano.
Oh, okay.
Elijah Wood plays a concert pianist who is being terrorized by a sniper.
Okay.
Who the sniper is played by John Cusack.
Right.
And it's a wonderful little thriller. It's really tight and concise, and it's a great thriller. And it shows that even in his later career, Cusack is still doing interesting things. Because a lot of people have seen Cusack now in his later career as being kind of like Nicolas Cage, where he'll do a lot of direct-to-video movies, and he kind of has become the butt of a joke amongst some film fans because of his choices. But if you give those movies a chance, Cusack's still doing interesting work in them.
Yeah.
And to give you the name of that movie, it's called Grand Piano. Mm-hmm. It co-stars Elijah Wood. Okay. It's a little 90-minute thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It's tense. It's interesting. And Cusack is wonderful in it,
right.
Playing a very different kind of character. Right. It really shows his range,
right.
And you can find it very easily streaming.
Can I give movies not to watch if you're a John Cusack fan?
Sure. It's a first on Video Culture, but let's movies to avoid with Ryan.
America's Sweethearts?
I don't like America's Sweetheart. That's a good call.
It's probably, like, I'm sitting here, like, literally, I'm looking at John Cusack's filmography. And it's just, like, astounding to me. 8 Men Out, Say Anything.
Men Out is so good.
The Grifters, Money for Nothing, City Hall, Gross Point Blank, Midnight of the Garden of Good and Evil. I mean, I forgot about that one. The Thin Red Line, High Fidelity. And then you get to, like, America's Sweethearts.
Yeah.
That is, like, I mean, and even, like, later on, you know, War, Inc., like you mentioned, and... Runaway Jury adaptation. He was in, you know.
Yeah. To me,
I mean, it just sticks out like a sore thing. It's such a horrible movie. It's a bad movie, and it's a bad movie that has John Cusack in it. It makes it even, like, sadder.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing that I got to think of a good way to sum up. If we wanted to, we could do an entire podcast show. And I mean, not just one episode, but an entire podcast theme around just John Cusack's filmography.
Yeah.
He's done so many interesting films throughout his career. We say this a lot, but he is a national treasure. He is one of the godfathers of video culture, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, in the last few movies that he has done since, like, you know, 2012 and on have been, like, direct to video on demand. Yeah. You know what I mean?
But some of them are good. I will say, I've seen a couple of them, and they are good.
Okay.
Yeah. So don't discount them just because they're direct-to-video movies. That's one thing about our world and how we consume movies is changing. Mm-hmm. Mid-range movies don't get to theaters a lot anymore.
Right.
So they go direct to streaming. It doesn't mean they're bad. Right. It just means that they don't think they can compete with, like, the big blockbusters. They don't have superheroes in them. They don't have, like, Star Wars in them. They don't have, like, big space battles.
Right.
But... you know, guys like John Cusack are still making interesting movies. Some of them are bad, sure, but there are still some good things worth checking out in his later direct-to-video content.
Yeah, like the stuff like Must Love Dogs or Serendipity.
Yeah, that would not get that would go direct. Must Love Dogs or Serendipity would be a Netflix original,
right?
If it came out today,
right? Exactly. Yeah,
it would. I mean, it would be a Netflix original movie.
Yeah, true. True. Well, I mean, somebody said that, I remember reading and doing research that, ABC, I think, was looking at, doing a Serendipity, TV show. I don't know how much truth that is. I didn't do much digging into it because we're not talking about that movie and, you know, I didn't want to really talk about Serendipity, but yeah, that just gives you an idea. You know, some of these good concepts, of movies or whatever, like, yeah, they wound up like TV shows, you know?
Yeah, they wouldn't be things you would go to the multiplex and see. Because the world's just changing, you know, when it comes to that.
Yeah, the consumption of how, like, those movies, like, is a lot different. Yeah.
It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't make them lesser. It's just the way we get them is different now. And I think John Cusack is still doing quality work. He still cares. And he, you know, he's still someone who's worth paying attention to. And he's made a lot of wonderful movies before, and I think he's still got a lot of wonderful years left in him.
Mm-hmm.
And John, if you're listening to this by any chance, We'd love to have you on the show. We I know we do that every time when we spotlight on an actor or an actress. But if you're out there, John, we think you're great, man. We are pro John Cusack.
No, I mean, I reached out to John on Twitter to see what he had to say about Pushing 10, because I'm sure it's not a movie that he gets asked a lot about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Of course, he did not respond, obviously.
Well, he's busy spouting off political beliefs that we kind of...
Yeah, he's too busy.
He's very into politics nowadays.
Yeah, getting mad at our president on Twitter,
which is understandable, you
right.
know. But John, we love you, man. Yeah. Thanks for making so many movies that have enriched our lives, brother.
Yes, thank you very much, John. I've you know, it's been a part of my childhood and growing up, and you know, really, one of my favorite actors of all time.
Really, part of our lives, yeah, not just our definitely. Childhood, our lives. And, you know, thank you to him, and thank you to you, our listeners, for hanging out with us today on Video Culture.
And don't worry, listeners, we will do, at some point, we will do Gross Point Blank. We probably will do, you know, we might do High Fidelity or Say Anything. I know we have plans on doing Gross Point Blank sometime in the future.
You do, because I really want to watch it again. I've not seen it in a while.
That is definitely another movie that fits perfectly, yeah. like as a cult classic movie.
You got to understand, we've got a massive list of movies that we want to get to.
Right.
And sometimes we just pick on random on where our whims are.
Right.
That week.
Right. And I didn't. You know, we didn't want to do two. You know, we didn't want to do those two movies because they're just so big, and we want to make sure that we're spotlighting, you know, somebody's like whole sort of like body of work.
Yeah. We want to suppose something you maybe haven't heard of or haven't seen, and that's why you chose Pushing 10. We thought it'd be an interesting one, and it ended up being an interesting one. And that's what we try to do here. And again, guys, thanks for joining us in the virtual video store. You know, it's been a pleasure, and we will see you in about 2 weeks' time.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Estrey. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us. Talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Does it ever feel like everyone's got more going than you do? Oops. That everyone is smart.
So you're Al Myers, kid?
Yes, I am.
You look pretty stupid to me.
Thank you.
You say the best skier in town just ran off with your girlfriend? Even your younger brother does better than you do? And that nobody even cares?
Seth broke up with me.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, you might be right. Oh! But remember one thing.
I haven't even been to New York City.
Nobody was ever better off dead.
The truth is, I could out-ski you any day of the week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you want a race, I'll take you on any day, sucker.
Go that way, really fast. If something gets in your way, turn.
All you need is guts.
All right! Now turn!
I'm gonna race, I'm gonna lose, and I'm gonna die in that order.
Go!
And you'll never doubt yourself again.
He's skiing on one ski!
Better off dead.
And that's a real shame when folks be throwing away a perfectly good white boy like that.
An abnormal look at a normal teenager.